We're back to the Neil Haley Show here on the Caregiver Dave Celebrity Segment. I'm excited to welcome program Caregiver Dave. It's Nasani. Dave, what's going on, man? How are you doing?
I'm excited. I'm pumped. I'm thrilled. My book was launched yesterday. We've already got 150 people who've bought it so far, and we are at the number one bestseller of a new release.
And that's congrats. And that's the thing about everyone's project. There is an opportunity, and this is what love is. Everyone has a story, everyone thinks. And Dave, you've worked hard. Congratulations on what you've been able to accomplish. And our guest today, Christopher Zaluski, is going to talk about Theirs is the Kingdom. And Christopher is the director of it. Christopher, thanks for stopping by. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
All right. So let's just, you know, just jump specifically in. Did you always want to be a director? Is this something growing up? One of the things I'm now trying to do, Christopher, is I'm niching down a little bit in my industry to start working with film directors and producers to help create tribes and communities. So I'm in this process of doing that to try to understand this industry more and more, because I do work with authors. I work with everyone around. But because of me being in the entertainment field, and I was a professional wrestler for X amount of years, and all these things, the movies and television just truly interest me. So I said, hey, based on my marketing skills and what I do, I really want to get involved and understand this. So is directing something you always wanted to do?
No, definitely not. I was always attracted to being a writer. So I wanted to be a newspaper reporter, and I was a newspaper reporter for a number of years. And, I got into nonfiction filmmaking and documentary filmmaking through that route. And so for me, it was always about storytelling. I didn't know the first thing about what a director of photography or an editor or a grip or a producer or any of that stuff. I got into it through just my background as a journalist. And then it slowly morphed into another mode of storytelling that was really effective. And so that's how I got into it. But no, for me, it's always about the story. So I was never really into, you know, being into movies or anything like that.
So into storytelling. So a lot of filmmakers, they go in the route of feature length films or documentaries. And what intrigued you is the story of documentaries. And people don't think about documentaries, even though lots of people do them, meaning the process of how you create a documentary, the way you do all these different things in it. Because again, you know, some documentaries go to the movies, but sometimes they're on PBS, different things like that. Yeah. Documentary person, do you see that filmmakers choose different routes? And one of the reasons, because the documentary is more of a telling a story in a way that's a real story sometimes compared to, you know, a full length feature film or a short?
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, for one, I'll say, I think that we're kind of in a golden age for documentaries right now. I mean, there's so many platforms that are in need of high quality nonfiction content. And so, you know, I think for a while, you know, if you were a documentary filmmaker, you were kind of like second tier. And there's still probably that perception, but there's a lot more of crossover right now between fiction filmmakers who try their hand in documentary, and then big time documentary filmmakers who are now getting the opportunity to tell fiction stories. I think that you see kind of the influence a little bit with both, for better and for worse. But I mean, for me, it was always, I never had the desire to make a fiction film. I was in the nonfiction world because of my background. And so it was just documentary was the most, you know, logical next step for me. But in terms of what you're saying, you know, is it about story or is it about the role? Like most of the productions that I've worked on has been small crews. And so I love the aspect of being in an environment, meeting people, talking with people that I never would have talked with before, and having my hand in all phases of production, from directing to filming to editing to producing. And so documentary also kind of lends itself to allowing me to have my hand in all aspects of production.
Dave. So true, Christopher, you know, and the fact that during the Academy Awards that independent filmmakers are now able to win a big award has really broken the barriers. I was in the right place at the right time and met a filmmaker. I just told him my story just because I was being sociable. And he says, wow, that'd make a great story. And he's already making a film. It started out as a documentary, but now it's a feature length film. And so I'm right there with you. Maybe this opportunity wouldn't have been there a few years ago. But what are some of the challenges of doing that?
Well, I mean, it's always a long game because it takes a while, especially if you're in the style of filmmaking that I've been drawn to recently, which is more observational or verite. So you start a film sometimes and you don't know how it's going to end. Mm-hmm. And so you're following a story for sometimes years. The most recent film of mine, theirs is The Kingdom. It took me about 3 years to make, which isn't that long in comparison. You know, I've had friends who've worked on films for 7, 10, 12 years. And so, you know, the challenge when you're working on a project that long is, well, one, that can't be the only thing you're doing. So how do you juggle that? You know, so you have funding issues, you have things like that. And then I think the second part is just burnout. I mean, we don't have big crews most of the time. You're working with crews of maybe 3, 4, 5 people. And so you're doing a lot of the work. And so you really have to love it. You have to be passionate about the film, the story that you're telling. And so I don't know. I think that there's a little bit of a grittiness to it that really attracts me, but it probably would be a challenge for a lot of people.
Yeah, I could say that. Go ahead, Neil.
Okay, great, Dave. So basically, how did this project start about There is a Kingdom? How did that happen?
Sure. Yeah, sure. So the film follows the creation of a large-scale fresco mural in the sanctuary of this small church in a town called Asheville, North Carolina. So I don't know if you're familiar with Asheville, a small town in western North Carolina. So I was living in Asheville at the time. A subject of mine from a previous documentary actually told me about this painting that was going to happen. And at the time she told me about it, there was a funding controversy kind of surrounding the painting. And I thought, oh, a controversy. Let me go figure this out. You know, it kind of felt like there could have been some drama. And I went and I heard the pastor of this church talk about what the painting meant to him. And I was immediately sucked in. And it was a much bigger story. You know, from the beginning, I realized it's much bigger than just this funding controversy. And so that aspect is a blip in the film, but it's much more about, you know, the overall message that the fresco is talking about. It's about carrying on an ancient, you know, technique that really isn't practiced all that much anymore. And so, yeah, just kind of snowballed. And I told myself it was just going to be a short film. That's a trick to trick myself into approaching a topic, because if you know you're going to be doing something for 3+ years, you're never going to do it. So it's just one thing led to the next, and I followed it for 3 years. Here we are.
Yeah, that's what my guy said too. It just developed. He didn't even know the name of it. He didn't know how it was going to end. He just kept going, you know, and he followed me around for 2.5 years.
Yeah.
And now a year of editing, and now he's going to polish that editing. What process, where are you in the process on this one?
This one's already released. This is the PBS and everything.
Yeah. So this, go ahead, Neil. Sorry.
No, I was going to add just the point of, yeah. So this is big. And he, during Easter, had it air in PBS stations. Chris, you can explain that.
Wow.
Yeah. So we had kind of our big broadcast release was in April, where we aired on 80% of PBS stations around the country on Easter. Whoa. And it still has a PBS run, but that was kind of like the big broadcast splash as part of the PBS World Channel. And now it's on Apple TV, Google Play, the YouTube movie section, the one you have to pay for the content. So it's now being released on streaming platforms. And that's really, you know, where we're seeing kind of the second wave of people who've seen the film.
Now, how did you get that content? Sorry. How did you get that that contact with PBS, and what was it exactly about the film that caught their attention?
Well, the contact was I mean, I work with different distributors and different people who kind of see the film, and you know, and this is part of it too. This is the third film I've made, and I've kind of learned a lot in terms of not holding on to the film so tightly during the post-production phase, letting people see it, building advocates for the film, you know, getting people excited about it that then will take it to their contacts and so on and so forth. And so that's, you know, kind of the process I went through with this film, was that I showed it to some key people, you know, maybe 4 or 5 months before it was completely finished. And I kind of created these advocates for the film that said, have you thought about PBS? Have you thought about this avenue or this avenue? For PBS specifically, I mean, the film deals with themes of faith. Although it is not a quote, you know, faith-based film, it does talk about faith, especially as it relates to this church that really deals with members of the homeless population in Asheville. And so you have faith, You have messages of poverty, homelessness, addiction, mental illness. And then you have all of this kind of encapsulated in this rare piece of art that's being created. And so those are kind of PBS friendly themes for the most part. I mean, we also did a pretty big film festival run in the second half of 2021 to kind of drum up support and credibility for the film. So that when we reached out to these other platforms like Apple TV and Canopy is another one that's going to start at this, that's an educational distributor. It had enough credibility, I think, behind it that people took notice.
So when you talk about the film festival run and stuff like that, Chris, that's the big part of independent filmmakers, right? Is once you know, you submit those to the film festivals and see what happens. And then when you get accepted, then that's the game on. It's the networking phase of it as a filmmaker, right? To really present it and talk to people, to find distributors and things like that, right?
Yeah, you know, the film festival world, and I'm certainly only speaking about this as an independent filmmaker. I have a lot of friends who work as programmers and work from the business side of the film festival world. So I'm saying this from a content creator standpoint, that it's changed a ton in the last 10 years. And part of that is you have big films now that completely bypass the film festival ecosystem and go straight to Disney Plus or go straight to Netflix. The film festival world isn't what it used to be as this gatekeeper. But I think it is still really important to what you said, Neil. Like a lot of people that I collaborate with on projects through film festivals. And I think it's also important, like I said, as kind of a stamp of credibility that allows, if it got here and here and here, it's a project that's worth, you know, giving somebody your attention.
So how many film festivals were you in and awards, I'm assuming? You won some?
Yeah, we were in about 15 and we won 3. Okay. You know, film festivals are challenging too. I mean, they're really competitive. And so we felt pretty good about that run though overall. And we just based on the geographic nature of the film, we did a lot in the Southeast, throughout, you know, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, but we also screened in California and New York. And so we've had, you know, a wider range, but it was concentrated in the Southeast.
Yeah. So basically in this process, what do you hope that the viewers get and the people who view the film get out of the film? What is your goal?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of themes in the film about accepting the other, whoever that other might be. I mean, that may be somebody on the street corner that we avert our eyes from. That could be somebody within your own community that you don't think about on a daily basis. And so there's a lot of themes of kind of challenging this notion of who the other is in our society. I also hope that, you know, if people see this piece of artwork and they're drawn to go visit it in real life. You know, it's a really amazing painting. It's 30 feet wide by 10 feet tall. The film cannot do justice to the real piece of art. And so I hope that it encourages people to go see the painting in real life if you're ever in Asheville. You know, and I have heard that from the church is that a lot of people come in because they saw the film. And so that's pretty encouraging.
So what did you learn? You know, this is your third film. What did you learn from the first two films? And if you could go back in time and you know, if you only knew, what would you tell yourself, that younger person?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I watch those films occasionally still. And there are things about them that I don't like. And there are things about it that I still feel hold up pretty well. So, I mean, I think, there's just some things that more in terms of the distribution strategies that I've learned a lot in, especially with this third film that I wish I had done, you know, especially in our first film. It's called Wagon Masters. It's a cultural history of the station wagon in America. And we did so well with that film. We didn't even realize it. Really? I mean, we were interviewed on CBS Sunday morning. Oh. CBS Saturday morning. Still national broadcast, flown to New York for this. You know, it was on, you know, it's on Amazon still. It's, but without knowing how to really push that out and capitalize on it, I feel like it kind of fizzled a little bit. And so most of the lessons that I've learned now looking back, I think are from the distribution side of things. I still feel pretty good with the filmmaking in all the films that I've worked on. They've been really different for me. It's not a topic that draws me in. It's the story, whatever that story might be, that draws me in. And so I feel good about that. But yeah, I probably would talk about the distribution side.
What has changed with distribution back then and now? Because everything is always changing.
Yeah. I mean, I think my perception back in 2011 was make a film, get somebody that sees it with money and they buy it and I sit back and they handle everything.
That's just
not realistic at all. I mean, even really big films, there's a level of independent, you know, you have to work on promoting it and doing all that on your own, no matter how good the film is. And so I think I probably would have been a little bit more proactive back then to try to get the film out there more.
Definitely. And so the intriguing part is that you have to be a hustler. You have to, the director, the person, this is your film, this is your baby. You need to be the hustler. You need to be able to get it and show it to different people. People understand the work that took place to get the success of being on CBS for the one film, to getting film awards like this film, mm-hmm. and then to be on a platform like PBS. It takes time and effort, and it's worth it in so many ways. But yet, a filmmaker, a young filmmaker, what recommendations would you give a young filmmaker today if they were going to try to be a filmmaker?
Networking. Networking's huge. I would definitely say you can't do everything by yourself. So create a team around you of people that you admire and respect and trust. That's super important. I would say that you can get people, I see this all the time, people get really bogged down with the technical requirements of whatever it is, what camera you're using, what software you have, what computer. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to be willing to go out there and film and talk to people and be in the field for long periods of time and really work a story to get all the, you know, all the information you need out of it. And that has a lot less to do with, you know, all the intricacies of being technical and all of that than it does just being gritty and going out and being willing to put in the time and the energy to make a good film. And so I think for me, I was too hung up on technology in the early days, trying to know all the facets of this and that. I think it's important to just there. Documentary filmmaking especially is a process of interpersonal relationships. You have to make people feel comfortable. You have to get people to open up to you. That's the biggest thing. And so it's just, I don't know, I'm kind of rambling here, but I think it's just about open and vulnerable and honest with subjects in the same way that you want them to be with you.
How long did it take you to get rid of all the side jobs and just, you know, devote 100% of your time on your films?
Oh, there's always a hustle. I mean, there's always stuff I'm doing. I'm teaching, I'm working on commercial projects, I'm doing film projects. I think that's always kind of a nature of the business. It kind of depends on what stage of the filmmaking process I'm in dictates how much energy I'm putting toward one thing or another. You know, fortunately for the last few years, I haven't had to do as many commercial projects because I've been focused, solely on my creative projects, which has been great. But I'll probably get more into commercial projects here now in the next year or so. And, you know, the pendulum swings back and forth, but you're always doing a bunch of stuff.
Well, it's good. You're an entrepreneur. That's the thing. That's the thing that you've been able to get to that level. All right, Dave, you have, Dave's final question is a caregiving question. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah. So 25 years ago, my wife had this headache. We've been married 47 years and it wouldn't go away. And it just turned into this stroke and she lost her speech, became paralyzed on one side. And the next 2 years, you know, we were grieving and deciding what are we going to do about this and reinventing ourselves. Almost broke up, but we hung in there. She became her old self again. And now I'm Dave, the caregiver's caregiver. I go on television programs, been on 52 so far, spoke all across the country, spoke in London at the London Stock Exchange, met great famous people that I shared the stage with. And I realized, because my message to caregivers is, you know, 30% of you are dying just from the stress. So you've got to learn how to deal with that. And even before you become a caregiver, you know, start thinking about this is inevitable. You're either going to become one or you're going to need one. It's the tsunami on the horizon. Mm-hmm. Have you thought about that and what you're going to do? I mean, are you in a position elderly parents, grandparents? Has it already happened?
You know, that's a good thing you bring up. I mean, I'm an only child, so I think about it all the time. I have both of my parents still. And so, I live about 7 hours. I live in North Carolina now. My parents are from Northeast Ohio. That's where I grew up. And so, yeah, I think about it all the time, and I don't have a solution, but I will say that my wife and I talk about it and try to figure out what we will do. My wife's one of three, and I feel like with the siblings, you have a little bit more, I don't know, flexibility sometimes with caregivers, but yeah, I think about that a lot.
Well, keep me in mind in my website, caregiverdave.com, because right. One day you're going to need it.
Yeah, everyone's going to need it at one point, Dave. And I think caregiving is also just talking to them, being a good contact in your family, your parents, your grandparents. That's part of caregiving as well. All right, Dave, appreciate it. And where can we check out the film right now? Where can we go,
Chris? You could watch it on Apple TV. You could watch it on Google Play. You can watch it on YouTube Movies. It'll be on Canopy for educational streaming. If you're part of a university or have a library card, you'll be able to watch it this summer on Canopy. Or if you just go to theirsisthekingdomfilm.com, we have a list of all the places you could see it there. We have new streaming platforms coming out every day. So if you search it, you can find it and watch it.
All right, Chris, thanks for stopping by. Appreciate it. Appreciate you too, Dave. And guys, take care. That was the Caregiver Dave celebrity segment. Take care, guys.